and comedy, from heavy metal standing hand in hand with our chants. We shall not be silenced by fearmongers and sycophants. The place where your neighbor is on your airwaves, a true community, celebrating diversity in thought, music, and love, where your stories are told in unison. The most loving words that we can say, and we say it so bold. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston. Welcome home.
Unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday 8 p.m. and it's time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm your host tonight, Warren Holloman. I'm proud to be on the So What's Your Story team with Mary Edgerton, Greg Aldell, Hank Rubicek, Eric Heen, Tatiana Gago, Chris Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and Paul Topekian. Each week, we celebrate the power of story by bringing you astonishing tellers who take us on captivating journeys, and then they bring us safely home. My guest tonight is David Watts, who just happened to be on the show exactly 1 year ago when he helped us get ready for the holidays by sharing his memories of Christmas growing up in Georgetown, Texas. David, welcome back to So What's Your Story?
Thanks, Warren. Good to be here.
We're delighted to have you back. I've got to say, I was checking up on you on WebMD and Yelp.com.
And I
noticed there was a Dr. Harvey David Watts, who was a gastroenterologist practicing in Mill Valley and San Francisco, California. And yet, when I searched your name at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com, I found a professor of poetry named David Watts, who had published a slew of books, stories, poems, detective novels, even a series of westerns. So I got to ask, how did a gastroenterologist find his way into poetry and storytelling?
Well, Warren, you have to remember I'm a wild and crazy Texan. What I learned growing up in Texas was that if you saw something that you wanted to do, you just went out and did it. And so along the way, when I was doing my training in medicine, I sort of started thinking about the examined life, you know, the life that you lead that takes a look at the things that you're experiencing along the way. And so I started writing poetry, and it was doing a lot of good for me to write this poetry. I felt like I was understanding more about myself doing it, but I wasn't doing very well in terms of the writing. So I ended up going back to college at night, taking some courses and going to some workshops and trying to perfect my art. And I discovered that it was really very important to me to be writing poetry, which then led to NPR commentary, which then led to stories and finally novels. So it's been a sort of avocation of mine along the way, but sort of something that keeps me centered.
And though your roots are here in Texas, even West Texas, which is real Texas,
yep,
you came of age in Houston, you landed in San Francisco, California.
Yep.
Your challenge, in 1 minute or less, explain how that happened.
When I was in high school and college, I wasn't too serious about academics, but I managed to wrangle my way into Baylor College of Medicine, right next door to you. And by that time, I decided I should be serious about what I was doing. So I got real serious about studying did pretty well and got into the Moffitt Hospital internship here in San Francisco, and stayed with that until I finished my training, and was then invited to become part of the faculty here at the University of California, San Francisco, where I have been in one capacity or another ever since, doing the poetry and the writing and things like that on the side.
I'm glad that we were able to reconnect after all these years and all these miles. I was on the faculty at Baylor for a long time myself, and that's how we sort of first became acquainted, when you came and spoke to the students there.
Yeah.
So speaking of medical schools, for the first segment, you've chosen to tell a brace of stories about healing. Healing is an important theme always, but especially, I would say, during these COVID times.
Right.
Tell us your stories.
All right. Well, I've been fascinated with the whole notion of the magic of the doctor-patient relationship. What makes that work? What makes it fail? How important it is in the overall process of making people well again. And it requires a lot of trust on both sides of the relationship. And you develop this connection between the two of you that really begins to make things happen. Magical things sometimes that are beyond science. And so I started paying attention to some of the things in my own practice. And this first little story I'm going to tell you, called Annie's Antidote, which is published in Bedside Manners, that book that Random House published of mine, is about a woman who had symptoms of peptic ulcer. She had pain. She couldn't eat well. And so we treated her like we would normally treat someone with ulcer disease, and she didn't get any better. So it came time for her to have what's known as an endoscopy, which is a way of looking inside the stomach with a flexible tube with a light on the end of it that tells you a little bit more about what's going on. Well, it turns out she had a morbid fear of endoscopy for some reason. She managed to endoscopy suite to sit on the table, but when she got there, she was nervous and sweating. Well, you know, you can't force a situation like that. So I was sort of standing around, the nurse and I, waiting to see what was going to happen next. And a couple of minutes went by, and she looked up at me and she said, "You know, you're a poet, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah, I guess." And my brain just went wonk from one side to the other. I was thinking about, you know, biopsy and pathology and Burset and Demerol and things like that. And suddenly I was thinking about poetry. And she said to me, she said, "You know, well, if you could recite a poem to me, I think we might be able to do this." I was astonished. Where did that come from? And I said to her, "Well, I only know one poem," because at that point in my life, there was only one poem that I knew, and it was one that I had written. And I asked her, was it okay if I recited that one? And she said, "Sure." So I told her this poem. "My son brings me a stone and asks which star it fell from. He is serious, and so I must be careful. Even though I know he will place it among those things that will leave him someday, and he will go on gathering. For this is one of those moments that turns suddenly towards you, opening as it turns, as if for an instant we paused on the edge of a heartbeat and then pressed forward, conscious of the fear that runs beside us and how lovely it is to be with each other in the long, resilient mornings." So after I had said that poem, I knew that I had done everything that I could do and the rest was not up to me. And about a minute went by and she sort of shifted there on the table and she said, "Okay, let's do this." She lay down, we did the test. 10 minutes later, we had the answer to her problem. And the answer was that she had an infection with the ulcer bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. And we would not have known about that except for the endoscopy. So I was fond of telling people that it was the poem that healed her, because without that, we never would have known what to do. So that's that little story of Annie's Antidote. And then there's one that I've called Silence Asks the Right Question. And that has to do with a young woman who had headaches for about 15 years. And she'd seen a lot of doctors, spent a lot of money, suffered a lot of tests and side effects, and still had her headaches. And so she gave up on the whole idea of seeing any doctor and just said, you know, I guess I got headaches and nobody can cure it. But a friend of hers got a hold of her and twisted her arm and said, go see Dr. Watts, see what he can do. So she came in the room, and you know, after you've been in practice for a while, and if you're paying attention, you can tell a lot about a person just by watching them come in the room. Facial expression, body language, things like that. I knew right away that I just better shut up and listen to what she had to say. So she sat down, she started telling her story, when she had her headaches, what they felt like, where they were, what was going on in her life at the moment, what medication she'd taken, the studies she'd taken, and then the fact, of course, she still had her headaches. So it took her about a minute and a half to tell me that. And what I realized is at the end of that was that I knew nothing more than any of the other doctors who had ever seen her, who probably were pretty smart people, because she had recited the story in the manner in which she was taught to recite it by the doctors who asked for questions in a certain order and a certain type. And you know, the amount of time it takes for a doctor usually to interrupt a patient when she's trying to tell her story is about 13 seconds. Well, I hadn't said anything. And at the end of this time, I didn't know what question to ask her, so I didn't say anything then. And we went on with silence in the room for maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes. Now, that's a long time for silence in a doctor's office, because you just don't get silence like that. But at the end of that time, she shifted in her chair. She flipped a little flotsam off of her skirt, straightened up and said, you know, there was something that happened to me last week that I do not understand. And I just nodded my head. And she said, I was going to see my accountant on the 13th floor of the Bank of America building. And I realized for the first time in my life, I did not want to be in the same elevator with my husband. And then she looked up at me and she said, what do you think that means? Now that is a dangerous moment, right? I mean, everybody who hears that story has some idea what that means, but she didn't know, which means that she'd been blocking herself against the knowledge of what that feeling meant to her all this time. So I said to her, I'm not sure, which was right. I had a notion, but I didn't know for sure. And I'd only known this person maybe 7.5 minutes. How was I going to tell her what to do with her life? So I said, you know, I think it's important, whatever it means, and you should go think about it, which she did. And she came back 2 weeks later. In that time, she'd rented a storage locker, she'd moved out her furniture, and she started divorce proceedings. And then she looked at me and she said, you did that. I said, I did not. All I did was listen to you, hear what you had to say. And then she said, you know, you're forgetting about something. I said, what is that? And she said, I don't have headaches anymore. So you see, sometimes science needs a little something else to make the diagnosis. A little time together, a little silence, a little mutual respect, a little time when you're not trying to show off how much you know or what you've been trained to do, but just step outside the moment for a minute and listen. Listening is very important. And there's one other little story, Warren. Do you have time for that, Carboni?
Yes.
So my mentor was a wonderful man named John Carboni. He was a well-respected gastroenterologist in California. And he had a lot of really wonderful patients. And one day, he was walking across the street to go to the hospital to visit a patient of his who was going to have surgery the next day. And he goes up to the 13th floor, walks in the room, and there's a medical student there with the patient doing what medical students do, that is to take this long and arduous history that they put in the chart. And it takes them sometimes an hour, hour and a half, even 2 hours to do this job. So Carboni walks in the room, he excuses himself, he sits on the bed, and he has this little conversation with his patient. What do they talk about? Well, they talk about whether the 49ers have a chance of getting into the playoffs. They talk about the fishing lure that they need on the Eel River to catch the right fish. And then at the end of this little conversation, he sort of pats the friend of his, the patient, on the arm, and he says, "Now, Mr. Johnson, I don't want you to worry about the surgery you're going to have tomorrow. You're going to do just fine." After which, he gets up and he walks out the room. Well, the patient turns to the medical student and says to the medical student, "That Dr. Carboni is so wonderful. He spends so much time with his patients." Now, the medical student had been there for a century, it felt like, and Carboni was there for, what, 3 or 4 minutes? But it was Carboni's who made the impression. And that's because Carboni had what's called presence. When he was talking to you, he was there in his full capacity to listen, to interact, and to do so on a plane which felt like friendship. And in that relationship, there's built trust. And in trust is when you get the best results for healing. So those are the stories, Warren.
So, David, what is it about listening that makes it such a powerful tool of healing? And as you said, in one case, even of making a diagnosis.
Well, you know, it's a contrast between a didactic approach where someone stands up at the podium and starts telling you things that are trying to make you think a certain way. That's a didactic approach. It happens in lecture halls and colleges and universities. Wherever there's someone on a podium, that's what happens. But there's another way of expressing a connection, and that is in a conversation that goes back and forth, in which both people are listening to the other person at a deeper level. And when that happens, you build a sense of trust and more communication happens. In that story about the headache, the person with the headache, that information had never come out in any of those doctor visits that she had for 15 years. And it was because probably the doctor visit went along a certain protocol where the doctor would ask the questions and she would give answers, rather than hearing the narrative of the story of the illness, because hidden inside the narrative was the answer to the problem.
And what would you like our listeners to take from these stories?
Well, that I think there's more to healing than just chemistry. It has to do with the spirit, with a sense of trust, with a sense of confidence. There's data that show that people do much better if they have what they believe to be a connection established with their doctor. Whatever that word connection means, trust or access to each other. But when they feel that way, they take less pain medications and do better. They show up in the emergency room less often. They make fewer telephone calls around their illness. They just do better if they have that connection.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. I'm Warren Holloman. I'm here with my guest, David Watts. He's just told us a set of stories about healing. And now we're going to talk about a slightly different topic. Yes, healing is definitely something we need during these COVID times. But another is love. The next segment, David has titled The Many Faces of Love.
So I guess what I'll do is to recite some poems about love. These are not poems that I've written, but poems that are present in the world literature that show three different sides of love. And the first one is a very, very old poem. It's over 2,000 years, maybe over 3,000 years old, ancient Egyptian poem. And it was probably intended to be recited at a wedding ceremony. It's called This Love. This love is as good as oil and honey to the throat, as linen to the skin, as fine raiment to the gods, as incense to the worshipers as they enter in, as this little seal ring to my finger. It is a ripe pear in a man's hand. It is the dates we mix with wine. It is the seeds the baker adds to bread. We will be together even after old age comes, and all the days in between shall be as food set before us, dates and honey, bread and wine. That poem is amazing to me because it shows us that the ancient Egyptians had a very deep concept of what love is. Love is not something that was invented somewhere along the way. It's been with us forever. And isn't it lovely that they knew how to use metaphor as a way of pushing the language to try to get to a deeper meaning? So the second one is a poem from the 20th century by a Swedish poet called Thomas Tranströmer. It's called fire scribbling, which would be the kind of writing that you do sitting by the fire. During the dismal months, my life sparkled only when I made love to you. As a firefly ignites, goes out, one can follow its flight in the night by glimpses among the olive trees. During the dismal months, the soul sat shrunken and lifeless, but the body made its path straight to you. The night sky bellowed. By stealth, we melt the cosmos and survived. To me, that poem explores the power of love to heal, because whatever that man was going through during that period of time, he thinks it was the love connection to this person that got him through alive. And it is true, if you look at studies that look at those who have love in their lives, those who have a love relationship going on, live longer, live healthier, live happier, and the healing processes are much quicker. And then there's one other poem that I'll recite, which is also from the 20th century, from Russia, from Anna Akhmatova. It's called The Guest. Everything was just as it was. A fine, hard snow ticked against the dining room window, and I myself had not changed. Even so, a man came to call. "What do you want?" I said. He said, "To be with you in hell." I laughed. "It seems you see a lot of trouble ahead for both of us." He lifted a dry hand to touch the flower. His eyes never left my ring. Not a single muscle moved in his serenely angry face. "How do you kiss?" he said. "How do they kiss you?" "Oh, I know. It gives him great pleasure, this hard and passionate certainty that there is nothing he needs and nothing I can keep from him." So there is a third aspect to love. First one that we recited being a marital love, the second one being a love relationship that healed, and this third one, something a little bit more about power and submission as a part of the love relationship. So those are my three poems, Warren, about love. What do you think?
I think it's nice to hear a doctor talk about love.
Yeah, it's important.
One thing I've observed these last 8 months or so is how doctors and nurses and other first responders, frontline people, have offered themselves to serve during this difficult epidemic. So they have practiced real love. But one thing I noticed when my wife was going through medical school and in her career is that it's not something doctors generally feel comfortable talking about. They just do it. So it's nice to hear you reflecting in these ways.
Well, I think part of the process of the education of physicians, since it's so steeped in science,
yes,
so devoid of the humanistic aspects of life, is that we lose our ability, our practice in sort of spending time within a kind of human environment that includes emotional content like love. So recommendations I've been making at various medical schools when I give talks there is for them to have a little poetry on the side, have a little storytelling, something to keep them in touch with their humanistic qualities along the way.
And just for our listeners, this movement is often called the narrative medicine movement. And David, our guest, has been a leader in that. In fact, he gave a Zoom grand rounds at Texas Children's Hospital just a couple of weeks ago on love of all topics. I think that was probably a first for the Texas Medical Center.
Yep, I'm sure it surprised them.
It was great.
I know it pretty well. So
yeah, I listened. I loved it. Well, I'm going to give you a chance to catch your breath. We're going to do our storytelling calendar, and we'll come back to more stories in just a couple of minutes. I want to begin by giving a shout out to our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. Thanks to the miracle of Zoom, the Guild continues to meet the fourth Tuesday of each month to swap stories and give feedback. It's a great way to learn about the art of storytelling. The atmosphere is casual, friendly, supportive. You'll meet like-minded storytellers and story listeners. Next meeting, it would be December 22nd. That's the fourth Tuesday by Zoom. If you check the Guild's website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, you'll see that the Liars Contest has been scheduled for, let's see, January 16th, 2021. You want to check that out. It's a great place to hear Texas Tall Tales. Also on the website, if you click on the Radio Programs tab, you'll get to hear 13 years of So What's Your Story. I think there's over 1,000 stories there now that you can listen to. Another organization that we're proud to be a part of is the Tejas Storytelling Association. Their web address is tejasstorytelling.org, www.tejasstorytelling.com. And if you go to their website, you'll see a calendar of storytelling events statewide. Because things are done by Zoom, you could participate in the San Antonio, the Dallas, the Austin, any of the other groups. You'll also see there the 36th annual Texas Storytelling Festival is scheduled for March 11 to 14 in Denton, Texas. There's one other storytelling event that I want to mention that we don't usually mention, and that is storytelling in your home. During this holiday season, it's a great chance to get together with family, with your family, at least those that you're podding with, or by Zoom with others, and share stories. Oftentimes on this show, we talk about the big storytelling venues, like the Moth or telling stories on the radio. But the best place to tell stories is around a dinner table, in front of a fireplace, on a porch. That's real storytelling. So I encourage you to do that. And by the way, if you want a little help in how to get that going in your family, there was a wonderful op-ed by David Brooks just a few days ago in the New York Times. If you will Google 9 non-obvious ways to have deeper conversations, you can see David Brooks's suggestions for how to turn holidays into times where you talk about more than just weather and sports. 9 non-obvious ways to have deeper conversations. He mentions, for example, we should ask elevating questions. What commitments have you made that you no longer believe in? Whom do you feel most grateful to have in your life? What problem did you used to have but now have licked? He suggests asking open-ended questions. Instead of the usual yes-nos, ask, what was it like to have this happen in your life? Tell me about the time, or how did you manage to cope when such and such happened? Deeper conversations, as the other David Watts, our guest, has pointed out, build trust. They're the oxygen of society, and that's exactly what we're all missing right now. Humans need to be heard before they will listen. David Brooks concludes by saying it's been a rough year for all of this, But these holidays, the possibility of deep talk is still out there, even over Zoom. So that's our storytelling calendar. And now I'm going to bring back in our guest, Dr. David Watts. David, you've told stories about healing, stories and poems about love. Your third segment is called COVID and Poetry, and it features a poem you published a few months ago in the New York Times. Take it over, David.
So this is a poem that, much to my surprise, showed up in the New York Times, thanks to Naomi Shihab Nye, who is the editor, the guest editor of that segment. And it has a thematic element quite by accident that sort of resonates with the situation that we were in COVID, with everybody sort of staying at home. And the poem is called Pause. All day in shelter on a granary floor, rain on the roof like buckshot in branches, aroma of wet earth, dry grain, the air unhurried and intentional. I have made a chair of hay bales, spread a saddle blanket, contained womb-like against the heft of the out-of-doors. There is the soft heartbeat of contentment, the dark print of my life outside the walls. So that was a poem that I wrote that's been published in Having and Keeping, which is a collection of my poems put out by Brick Road Poetry Press, and one which Naomi Shihab Nye decided to publish in the New York Times. So strange things happened during these quiet times that we spend at home, and I ended up making another direction in my writing that I had not predicted. There is this poetry form known as haiku. Probably a lot of people know about that. It's very short. It's from Japan. And it has two images in it that interact with each other. And I just started writing them in August, and I've written, I don't know, 500 or 600 of them by now. I'm not sure they're all any good, but there are a few of them that have gotten published already. So would you like to hear some of those?
Definitely.
They're really short, so I'm going to pause between them just a bit.
And by the way, for our listeners, David performed these haikus and several other poems for a group in San Francisco, and it's available online. I wish I could remember the... Do you recall how to get to that?
Or, I don't, but I'll try to have it by the end of the hour.
You send me the link, and we'll post it on our Facebook page.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so these things are really short, and they usually have a couple of images in them, and they usually have a reference to nature. After dusk, a chill creeps across the lawn over roots of old trees. You see how short that is? And the idea is to put these images in front of you, because images have a great power in terms of layers of meaning. And it's interesting because poetry tries to say in a very few words something which resonates through a lot of different meanings, whereas the science approach to truth is to eliminate all the different meanings and focus on one specific thing, maybe change one thing in the environment and observe a difference. So there's two different approaches to trying to get at truth. Here's the second one. Thread of moon, sliver of soap in the dish. So you see there's a similarity between the soap shape and the shape of the moon and those two images that interact with each other. Here's another. The oboe of longing. Between her lips, the reed sings. And this is another one. You never know what's going to come forth when you start writing. And that's one of the beauties of writing, is that it gets into the unconscious a little bit, where we store some of the more important emotional currents of our lives. And here's one that just popped up about my brother. In my head, the songs he liked to sing. My brother's grave. And this last one, which is has a theme of Christmas about it, was selected by a journal in England called Spelt, S-P-E-L-T. And they've done something very interesting. They've done what they call a virtual Advent calendar, which starts on December 1st. That'll be a couple of days before this airs. And each day there's a new haiku that will appear on their website at the Spelt Journal of Haiku in England. And this one was selected for the Christmas Eve window. Freezing midnight mass, no fuzz around the boy's pure notes. That recalls an experience I had in Germany showing up for a midnight mass in a cathedral there. And it was freezing. When there's something about the cold that makes musical tones pure. There's no distortion. They just come through that cold, thin air right to your ear. So that was the memory that caused me to write that haiku.
What was it that drew you to this new medium of poetry?
I have no idea. You know, these things happen sometimes. I mean, I could say that it's because two of my sons speak Japanese. One is very fluent in the language and has visited Japan, loves the culture. I think that I had been going through a process of taking long poems that I've written and making them shorter and shorter and shorter. So I spent some time writing poems that had 31 words in them and collected them into various chapbooks. And then this maybe was a natural progression where I would come down to less than 17 syllables to make these little concretions of ideas in one place.
David, I recall about 10 years ago, you and your wife, Joan, made a documentary called Healing Words, and yes, it featured a couple of poetry therapists in hospitals around the country. It was featured on PBS. Tell our listeners about that documentary.
It's called Healing Words, Poetry and Medicine, and it was about a organization in the Shands Hospital in Florida, okay, which brought to the bedside various forms of art. So you had painting, you had dance, you had music, and you had poetry, and sometimes even drama. And what that did for these patients who were hospitalized, usually with diseases which kept them there for a few days, was it gave them a sense of mastery, a sense of being in charge of their own destiny. You feel very helpless sometimes when you're in a hospital and you're under the power of the doctors that come and go and the technology that gets pushed your direction. So to maintain your individuality and your sense of self, it's good to reawaken the humanistic side of your experience. So there was a documentary about that, and it showed up on PBS from, I think, about 2008 to 2012. It's still available on their website.
This is So What's Your Story on KPFT FM 90.1 in Houston. I'm here with my guest, David Watts. For the fourth segment of our show, David, we're going to switch gears a bit. And David is going to tell us a bedtime story. It's a little different from some of the bedtime stories you may have heard. It reflects David's West Texas roots, and so it's a little bit of a Western story as well. David, share with us the legend of Snakebit McCoy.
Yeah. I started writing Westerns, sort of not by my own choice. but because a publisher in England wanted me to try a Western, he'd read some of my work somewhere. So I wrote one for him, and it worked out pretty well for everybody. So they kept wanting me to write more. Now I've written, I think, 8 novels and 2 or 3 collections of short stories. This is a little short story that actually is being published this week by these folks in England. It's available on Amazon, and it's called David Watts Presents Stories of the Old West. And this one is the lead story in the book. It's called The Legend of Snakebit McCoy. Tell me a story, Grandpa. Supper was over and Aunt Annie Lee had cleared the table. She was chewing on a biscuit to clear her throat of any sweetness left over from a mound of food capped by a great big pumpkin pie. Grandpa Ellis was fiddling with his pipe, trying to get it to stay lit. The pot belly was a wash of warmth against the chill of the north wind, whistling down upon the farm, raging like a freight train over the high prairie of West Texas. "Aren't you a little old for a bedtime story?" Grandpa said. Charlie Bob cocked his head to one side and let the curl of a grin tug at the corner of his mouth. "Aren't you a little old to be telling them?" "Don't get your meaning," Grandpa said. "Didn't give it yet," Charlie Bob said. "Well, pray tell, because the cows in the shed and the corn done been siloed, and I'm sitting here with my teeth in my mouth." Charlie Bob smiled. "Well, you sure are full of stories when you and Dad and Uncle Walter sit around this here potbelly and try to outdo one another." His dad piped up from across the room. "Good way to pass the cold nights, Charlie Bob," he said. "And by the way," Grandpa said, "what do you know about all that?" Charlie Bob wriggled in his chair. "Well," he said, "there's the one about how a tornado drove a broom straw clean through a brick without breaking either one of them." Charlie Bob paused and measured the expression on the face of his listeners. There was a flicker of sudden interest around the room. "Then there's the one about the fellow who got his wallet stolen out of his breast pocket at the carnival by somebody who brushed him with a razor between his fingers and slit open the bottom of his pocket." He gulped for some air and went on. "And how a friend of his who lost the wallet stuck a plank of wood in his pocket in hopes of catching the varmint, but he got that stolen too." Grandpa smiled a smile that said he was beginning to understand Charlie Bob's secret life of spying. Grandpa was caught napping for a second, and Charlie Bob just kept on going. "Then there's the one about how Uncle Caleb's hot wife took the preacher in the tool shed while Uncle Caleb was idling his car in the driveway." Grandpa raised his hand. "Hold on there, buckaroo. That's quite enough out of you." He scratched the stubble on his chin and fumbled his cold pipe, struck a match, lit it, and leaned back in the rocker. Annie Lee shook her head and sighed. "Seems you've been sneaking around eavesdropping late at night when you're supposed to be sound asleep in bed," Grandpa said. "Maybe, but seems there's some old folks around here who do a lot of storytelling in the night." Grandpa took long puffs from his pipe and then cupped it in his hand. "Then I guess you better hear The Legend of Snakebit McCoy." "Ears wide open," said Charlie Bob. Grandpa leaned back and rocked 3 times. Patrick McCoy was a sprightly fellow, but he had one flaw, and that was he always had bad luck. "That's why they call him Snakebit? Now hold on your horses. That comes later. You reckon you could listen a while?" "I'll try." "Rumph," said Grandpa. But he knew that was the best he was going to get from Charlie Bob, so he went on. One day he was out riding his pony through the cotton field. It was about the same time of year we have now, where the cotton was done picking. And he saw a jackrabbit spring up in front of him. For some crazy reason, he decided to give it chase and galloped across the field to the fence where the wily rabbit ducked into a hole in the ground. Grandpa raised his eyebrow. He dusted some ashes from the bowl of his pipe with his thumb. The boy stayed fixed. "Now, there's a couple of things you want to know about a hole in the ground. And one of them is, who lives there?" Patrick was a little slow to consider that fact on this fateful day, and without giving it a simple thought, got off his horse and reached into the hole. To this day, I don't know what he expected to find by doing that. Maybe he thought the rabbit would conveniently be waiting for him to yank him out by his ears. Maybe not. I don't know any rabbits who think that way. Anyway, he got a little nick on his finger. Grandpa stopped and brushed his fingernail across the side of his index finger 3 times. Got a little nick, he said. Just a little nick. The boy's eyes opened wide. Well, I have to tell you, he left that rabbit be, and he headed on home thinking he got stung by a stinging lizard. Wait, hold on here. Why, what's a stinging lizard? Oh, that's what I call a scorpion. Anyhow, by the time he got back to the house, his arm was black as pitch and looked all crinkly. He figured something real bad happened, and he went to the hospital where they gave him anti-venom, and he survived. But after all, his arm got withered and shrunk. What was it, Grandpa? Well, when he got out of the hospital, he went back with a shovel and dug out a dead rabbit and a rattlesnake about 5 feet long. The only thing that saved him was that that snake probably wasted a lot of its venom on the rabbit. Okay, now I catch on. That's why they call it snake bit. Grandpa nodded and pointed at the boy with his pipe. But there's more to one meaning to that term, he said. He puffed on his pipe and blew a smoke ring. It also means bad luck, which is one thing he already had a bunch of. He turned his pipe to one side and then back in his mouth. But it gets a lot worse after that. I don't like this story already, the boy said. Grandpa leaned forward. What you got to know about stories is that they might have a little bad news in them, but there's always something to learn. The boy looked sideways at the man. Okay, go on then. Well, that snake bit reputation and name followed him around ever after. In high school, he fell in love with Becky Sue, but she jilted him for the captain of the football team. When he grew up and started a farm, a blight of locusts came and ate up all his crops. He finally got a wife, the preacher's daughter, but she got on a train for California and never came back. About that time, the bank foreclosed on his farm and sold his land to his neighbor. So when does this awful story get any better? It's about to. I can hardly wait. Grandpa chuckled. Well, Snakefoot McCoy had a reckoning. And with his last few dollars, he bought himself a peacemaker and started practicing quick draw, pelting holes in tin cans wherever he found them, until he was good enough to rob a few banks. Rob a few banks? Did that surprise you, boy? Kinda. Well, you already knew he didn't like banks much. But what about his withered arm? You see, that was his left arm. He drew and shot with his right. And even though his one arm was spidery, he could still hold a bag of gold. Charlie Bob nodded. But wouldn't his withered arm make it easy to identify? With a long-sleeved shirt, it looked just like any other, just shorter. Stubborn look crossed Charlie Bob's face. Seems like he'd get caught pretty easy. Well, you see, the townsfolk didn't mind if a bank got robbed, seeing as how the banks charged them a lot of interest, you know. And they might cheat him a little from time to time, power and temptation being what they are. So whenever a bank got robbed, the townsfolk were kind of happy. That turned out to be true in most towns. No love lost on bankers. Besides, old Snakebit would drop a gold piece in the parson's offering plate or leave one in the schoolhouse mailbox. So it was kind of like he was a Robin Hood of sorts. Nobody wanted to turn him in. Charlie Bob was quiet for a moment. It'd be nice if the story stopped right there, but I know it won't. So what am I in for now? Okay, you're right. One of old Snakebit's capers went a little sour when a posse happened to be standing around looking for somebody to chase. At the very same time, he came dashing out of a bank with a fresh bag of gold under that withered arm of his. He took his horse, but they chased him up the canyon, where he hid out in a fishing hut and started taking pot shots at him. The posse backed down the canyon, crossed the river, and came up the other side. They found a few boulders to hide behind, and thus begins the famous Palo Duro Canyon standoff. Looks kind of bad, Charlie said. Yep, it does. The posse started to fill the shack with bullet holes. But lucky for Snakepit, there was the cast iron stove in there he could hide behind. Hold on a minute, said Charlie Lott. You said lucky? Lucky for Snakepit? Are things starting to turn for him? You might say that. Let's see what happens next. Okay. So in order to save ammunition, Snakepit would stop shooting every now and then. Then the posse kind of thought he might be out of fire or maybe wounded somehow, and they started creeping up closer. That's when Snakepit would drive him back with another round of lead. The standoff kept being a standoff, but there was a problem in the long term for Snakepit. It wasn't going away easy. He had no way to get out of there without being seen, and nighttime would surely be protected by sentries at all the exit points. He was stuck and running low on supplies. Did he think about dying? Sure he did. Of course he did. You see, the life of an outlaw is not long anyway. So they constantly live for the expectation that some fine day somebody is going to put a bullet in a rather important part of their body. A dreamy look crossed his grandpa's face. They live well, but not long. Charlie Bob looked glum. Stick around, son. Don't leave the story before it's done. Okay, but you're asking a lot. Life asks a lot sometimes, I guess. Okay, so every now and then a few shots got exchanged across the river, but it seemed like the posse was waiting for him to run out of food or ammunition and give himself up. Snakepit knew there would be a risk in giving up. They might shoot him anyway and claim he was trying to escape. He was trapped, wasn't he, Grandpa? Trapped with no way out. I guess it's all over. Surrounded by seven men with guns, a cliff behind him, and a river in front, not much chance of escape. So is it all over? What do you think? Looks like. Yeah, it did look that way because the posse was gathering as if to charge his hut. If that happened, he would surely die. Oh, no. Grandpa rocked back and waited a minute. Don't do what? Don't make me wait. Geez, get on with it. Grandpa smiled. Well, about that time, some very dark clouds started appearing upriver. You know, the kind of clouds that come on sudden-like, and by the way they look, they're just as sure as Bessie's going to sing at church that something big is in the making. Well, that's what happened, and directly the rain began to fall. It wasn't a small rain, neither. It was one of those torrential gully washers mixed with hail. It sometimes hits all of a sudden, and there's nothing to do but get inside real quick and hunker down. So the shot stopped, the posse backed up, and side of the cliff under an overhang of rock, hiding from the rain. It got real dark in the middle of the day. Grandpa paused and looked at his pipe. What do you figure happened next? Don't know. The posse go home? Nah, they wouldn't give up that easy. I don't know. Well, when a lot of water hits the ground too fast to sink in, and it runs off to places it can only drain to from every direction, which usually is to a river or a creek bed nearby. And if that river is located in a place with high walls on either side, then you got what you call a flash flood. The water can rise in a river or a creek like that faster than you can say Jack Robinson, and something will come down as a wall of water 20 foot high and wider than a Mack truck, which is what happened. That's what happened. That high wall of angry water picked up Snakepit, fishing hut and all, and whisked him house and horse down the river about 60 miles an hour to where the water spread out onto the plain and he could manage to step out and just walk away pretty as you please. And the posse, some up the side of the cliff, some down the river, and some unaccounted for. So he got away and changed his name and went out to Wyoming where he got married, had a bunch of kids, and ran for sheriff. Ran for sheriff? Well, he pretty much knew life inside and out, didn't he? Charlie Bob was quiet a moment. You said stories teach. What does this one say? Ah, well, now that's whatever you can take out of it. A good story will teach different things to different folk. And if it sticks around for a while, tucked away somewhere in that little chink in your mind, you might find a quite different meaning years later. Stories are funny that way. The boy sat for a moment. Annie Lee looked up from her knitting and said, "Maybe it's about time for somebody to go to bed." Charlie Bob froze in his chair. Then he got right up and headed out of the room, but he stopped at the door. He waited a second and turned back. He was pretty lucky after all. Snakebit was. Wasn't he, Grandpa? He was. He was indeed. Faced death and got away. He looked at his pipe and left it where it sat. He turned and Charlie Bob was still there, standing by the door. "Maybe he deserved a little good luck," Grandpa said. "What do you think?" "Maybe he did," said Charlie Bob.
Well, you said that the stories have various ways of educating us and various meanings. All I could think about was this is also a story about the year 2020.
Yep.
Talk about being snake bit, and we're waiting. Maybe we've gotten that flood that's going to clean house and help things be better next year. We're out of time, but I want to give you just a second to say something about how we can get your books, how we can stay in touch with you.
Well, they're all on Amazon. There's a group of Westerns. There's a couple of mystery novels set in San Francisco. There's some poetry books. And I think, you know, if you just go, if you Google for my books under my name, David Watts Books, you'll find some. Or if you just go to Amazon and look under my name, there's a couple of new ones that just came out that this story I just read is the lead story in a book that's just coming out this week called The Tales of the Old West. And, I think that'll give you more than you can read.
Great. Well, David, thank you for being on the show. And
pleasure.
We hope you'll come back next year and share with us one of your other Christmas stories and many of your other stories as well.
Been a pleasure. You're doing good work there, Warren. Thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you. It's just a pleasure. This is my way to stay in touch with an old friend. I love it. Well, that's it for tonight, but don't you dare move because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tape Deck. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
Every day, in America, tens of thousands of people are trafficked, bought, sold, and sexually exploited. Demand Abolition is committed to eradicating the illegal commercial sex industry in the U.S., and by extension, the world, by combating the demand for purchased sex. Demand Abolition insists an inherent human right is that no person can be bought or sold. Sex buyers or johns drive the illegal sex trade. Without their money,